Blog Talk Radio.
Python Radio, brought to you by Morelia Python's forum, www.moreliapythons.com, where right now we're sort of doing a live chat. I don't have Owen with me yet. He's going to be here soon, but I do have, I believe he's there right now. That's Zach. Hey, Zach, what's up?
Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
Not much. Pretty good. We're just going to go barreling right into it, so you're going to just tag along for the conversation here that we're about to have with Rob Stone.
Oh, man. Good stuff.
So good stuff. we won't do any banter back and forth. We'll just get right into it because I talked to Rob the other night on the phone for quite a long time, and we had quite a good conversation, so we want to get that out to you guys. So if you want to go over to the forum, I'm going to try my best to monitor the chat as I talk, but we'll see how that goes. But it's www.moreliapythons.com. Without further ado, let's get Rob on here. Hey, Rob, welcome to the show. Welcome to Morelia Pythons Radio. Glad to have you.
Cool. Thanks, Eric. Hey, what's going on, Zach?
How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. How about you?
I'm good.
Right on. Yeah, Eric was telling me you were just over at his place, and then I brought up whether you had started talking about those occipitalis that were on Kingsnake, 2 weeks ago or so, and started laughing about that, so.
Yeah.
That's a dream for you, right, Zach?
Yes, it is.
They're pretty badass little things.
Yeah.
Oh, without a doubt. Oh, man.
Yo, man, wait a minute. We're talking blue tongue skinks here for a second, and your passion is at like a -6, man. Come on, get a cup of coffee or something.
I'm sorry, bro. I'm sorry.
This is blue tongue skinks.
Wait, I'm downing cereal, some Raisin Bran, because I didn't have any dinner. I'm trying to keep it together. Oh yeah, blue tongue. Oh man.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
It seems like recently there's been like a kind of a lot of crazy rare species of blue tongue kind of popping up here and there, blotched and westerns and centrillions and you know, it's been a good time to be a blue tongue enthusiast. It's a bad time to be broke though, I tell you, man.
Well, right. I mean, it's a good time to be a blue tongue enthusiast if you just got an extra 20K sitting there so you can pick up one of those groups, right?
Yeah.
I think it's a lot cheaper to just get yourself a ticket, frankly, but you know.
That's only $5,000, right?
Well, I know, right?
Wait, he hung up on us. He fell off the line. Yeah, so yeah, we're going to talk. We have quite a variety of topics that we're going to hit on and get through. One that I'm excited to talk about is we're going to talk about Halmahera scrub pythons. You've worked with a group of those, and you've actually worked with a lot of different stuff. And you know, we're going to hit on that. We're going to hit on some reptile business talk. We're going to talk about some of the things as far as you know, just where it's going, where the future is. There he is again. Hold on, let me get Zach back on here. So we said,
I'm sorry,
we
man.
Said 20K and you're out. 20K, he's out. I can't take it. I hang up.
Yeah, man, but it's crazy prices. Crazy, crazy prices for some of those things. To me, it's perfectly worth it. My goodness. But, you know, I know a lot of the Australian guys are looking at us like we're crazy because they can go to the backyard and catch shingle bags, you know what I mean? And we're like, you know, killing each other for 5K on one, you know? They have them on every pet store, like at Dan Petco or something over there in Australia. And here we're like, you know, jonesing to get one of them. So it's pretty crazy.
Isn't that funny?
I mean, to me, so what's your favorite one of those blue tongues?
Oh, man, we're good. Do you really want me to start this, Eric? I don't know, man. We may not even hit Helm Harris, dude, if you start me on the blue tongue rant. But,
yeah, go for it, man. Go for it.
My favorite. Oh, my goodness. It's like
the Centralia. It's the multifasciata right there. Beautiful. They're supposed to be nasty little ships, to be honest, but they're beautiful, beautiful, beautiful animals. I think the Alpines and those Occipitalis are supposed to be the nicest ones, right? And, I mean, they're beautiful, too, but...
Yeah, but see, the thing about the Centralians is I hear they're almost like, you know, they're supposed to be really short and stubby and fat. And actually, I always heard they were laid back, not the wild ones. But I always heard the captive bred ones are pretty laid back. But my favorite blue tongue enclave, it has to be anything Gigas. So anything that comes from Indonesia, I'm like all over. And my favorite being the Key Island skinks are probably my favorite of all blue tongues. They're just so cool, man. They're just so cool. You know, they got this really kind of, you know, they look like a granite eye jig, you know, like they have this really cool pattern, you know, really broken up. And when they're born solid pattern, you know, really banded. And as they grow up, that banding fades away and they get these olive and green and yellow and orange coloration come through. And they get this white nose on the face and white labial markings. Oh, man. The best. They also tend to be really feisty and, you know, high-strung, which is super cool, especially on blue tongues. It's almost laughable because they try to be a lot bigger than they are, so that's always fun to see. And, you know, they have the scales like glass, you know. They're, like, really shiny, and you know, you hold them and they feel like a piece of iron because they're really heavily built. They're hands down my favorite, without a doubt. Then again, I did, I hold a shingleback in ICAST, and I gotta say, man.
They're pretty badass lizards for sure.
That's everybody's favorite. So I can't really like say that's my favorite because I mean they don't count. I mean that's a given, dude. They're that cool, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, is anyone doing the Kais anymore? Sorry, Eric.
No.
Either.
That's cool. Yeah.
Can you repeat that?
I know Psyche got out, right?
Is anybody breeding the Kais?
Andrew Psyche?
Oh, the Kais. The last breeding I know was Ray down there in Florida.
Mm.
He had the breeding, I think, in 2011, 2010, I think was the last captive breeding of Kais. And what's crazy is there's a video of him finding the babies in the cage. And then the video keeps going, and it's exciting, and then all of a sudden... He goes to close the tub that she's in, and she turns around and decimates one of the babies. Just totally, like, chomps his head, you know, like, oh, my God. And you hear Ray in the background going nuts, like, as all of us would, you know. And he's like,
right.
Oh, my God, you effing mother. Yeah, you know, he's just going crazy. Dude, it's a crazy video. Like, the first time I saw the video, I was really psyched, and then I felt like I was, like, a knife in my heart, man. It was like, oh, my God. You know, and that's the last known breeding I know. And I think he only had two in that litter, and then one was killed by the
one got
money, so he only had one. And I don't know if he sold it or kept it. I really don't know. I've been looking to get in contact with him and see what he did to breed those guys because they're supposed to be, you know, difficult. You know? And I think what it comes down to is we're not keeping them warm enough, and I also believe that we're not giving them a wet season. and that we are not giving them the security they need and just leaving them the hell alone. And I'm sure we're going to probably talk about that when you get some scrubs, because that's...
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's going to tie into your thoughts as far as... Because I know you keep... sometimes you get a little bit of some flack for how you keep the dunks, and I'm with
you
there.
Because,
are you kidding? Because I get flack, too, on how I keep certain things. But, you know, hey, man, if it works, that's the key, you know. So we'll get into that and break that down. But I'm with you, man. I saw that video. I think you sent it to me. You linked it over to me, and I was watching it, and I never expected what I saw to happen. Oh my God, it's crazy, you know, because I don't really know that much about blue tongue skinks, and I'm like, never in a million years did I think I would see that. And then remember that video you sent me where the two males met in the wild on the lady's porch over in Australia, and they just like just like annihilated each other. It's like, oh my God, you know, good Lord.
Yeah, they're man, they're little bulldogs, man. They don't play around, and so. And it's funny because you look at them and they, you know, they have these little short little legs, and you're like, well, how vicious can that thing be? And oh man, they could go at each other, and they really can. So, yeah, that's another cool video. My goodness, that video is awesome. They're death rolling each other and like, what is this? A crocodile? It's like crazy. They're death rolling each other, and then at the end, the one male goes running, the other one goes following it, and it's like the funniest little thing. Because they look like your dogs, like your dachshunds running, you know what I mean? Kind of like, oh, it's hilarious.
He just takes off, and he's just like, his little legs are going like, gee, you know? So, yeah, cool stuff. But, yeah, so I guess we'll get this going, because this is the first time you're here on Morelia Python Radio. So I guess we'll start at the beginning. How did you get into reptiles, Rob? Give us your story of how you got into it.
Right on. I think it is. I don't know. I don't have a crystal clear. I know Barczyk had said, oh, he remember his first memory is going to the, you know, Belle Isle and stuff. I don't have it like that, but I do remember kind of fitting in the same box. When I was 4 or 5, I went out to Cleveland, flew out to Cleveland on whatever, Continental, I guess is the, you know, it's a Continental hub, so it's probably Continental. And this would be, I don't know, late 80s, early 90s. And this gal I was sitting next to had like the mini critter keeper with some sort of colubrid in there. I couldn't tell you what. Now it's corn snake, king snake, something like this. And apparently this was the time and place where that was not, you know, totally nuts. I get off the plane. Had done me, you know, unaccompanied minor bit to going out to grandma's place. And, you know, everyone's kind of, yeah, whatever. So that I think was pretty much the seed. My mother's friend, who actually lived in Cleveland, had a couple really big common boas, too. And I actually have this picture around here somewhere. It's pretty funny. I'm unfortunately grasping the thing behind the head. I'm not really throttling the thing, but, you know, I was still kind of freaked out, as you can see in the picture. But it's got to be like a 40-pound boa, you know, on me as a 5 or 6-year-old. And, you know, draped over my shoulders. And seriously, the thing's like, I don't know, you know, these things get massive. It's got to be 8 to 10 inches thick. You know, it's a big snake.
Wow.
I'm kind of half-smiling or whatever, but I think that had to be kind of the start. And then I lived in Southern California at the time, and I remember this. I do remember vividly being in kindergarten or first grade, something like this, and at recess or after school or whatever, some kid says, hey, without hiking, you know, in the little kid way, this is nowhere near as excited as he was, you know, that he was out hiking in some trails or something like that in the canyon, and he saw a snake, and everyone just thought this was the shit. And, you know, I certainly did too, and I got the old man to take who ate snakes, actually. Got the old man to take me out there. And we walked around for a while. I think saw some lizards. We definitely did not see any snakes, but I think I thought that was badass that, you know, this was a possibility. So I grew up a little bit and moved to Hungary. Got some dime store red ears and stuff we can't even, well, I suppose you can buy here if you say it's for science or whatever, but you're not really supposed to. I had a whole, you know, gaggle of those things running around. That was pretty chill. And I think the first real pet snake was, you know, newborn, totally, you know, looked at retrospectively, right? Totally hatchling little boa constrictor, you know, from the mall pet store. And I wanted, this is great, right? You know, I wanted the berm, But fortunately for me, well, I suppose it doesn't really matter. I'll get to that in a second. But, they said, no, you should go with the common boa. Their good advice kind of ended there when they said, oh, you know, and for info, you should go check out the Audubon Field Guide of, like, reptiles and amphibians in North America. Problematic. But I suppose you might get some Mexican, you know, imperator, but it's not their advice, to be sure, you know. So the things might infest it. They send me home with the heat rock on the astroturf, you know, the typical terrible setup, right? You know, and with the half log that doesn't fit, you know, any animal actually appropriately. Or at least nothing in that diameter, you know, in that width of a log, right? So this is kind of the start, and the thing ended up dying within, I don't know, 2 to 3 weeks, take it back. And so now I've got credit there. That's why I say, I guess it really wouldn't have mattered if it was a worm, because if it died in 3 weeks, that was not going to eat me in 3 weeks.
Right.
But I think I got credit and then went, like, the amphibian route. I remember, so this would be, like, 96, 97, something like that. Dante Finolio, who's a great naturalist, amphibian guy, still to this day, articles in the Reptiles Annual or whatever, so I'm all about that. Hell, I still have, I don't think I have the original one. I think I bought it back for nostalgia, but the 98 Reptiles Annual just kind of, that was one of the first seminal things to me, and as you and I talked about, Eric, this was kind of, I think really timing-wise, kind of the last of the super literate, you know, literary-based generation kind of across a wide swath, you know? Like, Kingsnake was just getting started. I think that was 97. And I'm seeing ads in Reptiles say, you know, saying, A, Kingsnake, and B, you know, check out my site, Al Zulich, right? You know, he's one of the early adopters. And Python Pete, you know, these guys too. So that was, you know, that was pretty cool. And seeing all that stuff, Casey's stuff, obviously. I think the big next step was that Prototics moved from Boulder to Denver and then into a retail facility in Denver in, I want to say, 99. Maybe it was 2000, something like that, though. You know, and I was out there for that grand opening where they had all these football, chat out all these football players out and stuff. And kind of from that day forward, I had wanted to work there. And I eventually did, starting, I think, in my junior year of high school or so. And I worked there up through college basically just for snakes. I wasn't getting paid. It was, but it got me into getting, you know, I bought from them all sorts of blood pythons, you know, Robin's naming Dinker blood pythons after me because I'm buying all of them, you know, stone phase, you know, all this stuff. Got knobtails from them, got ackies from them, got rhino rats from them, you know, so that's kind of where all that stuff started for me. And around that same time, this is the good one, around that same time, so when I was in Hungary, my best friend was from Belgium, and we all went to this international school in Budapest. And he moved back shortly after I did. He moved to Belgium, I moved back to the States. And, you know, I would go, every other summer I would go there if he would come here. And trust me, you know, loving beer like I do now, I definitely missed out to a certain extent. You know, 4 or 5, you know, months in Belgium, and I, you know, not a drop to drink. So I'm setting up to go there. I think I'd be 14 or 15. So the statute of limitations on this is run at this point. So I think we're good. But one day I just said, you know, when I'm packing up to go, I thought, I should bring him some snakes. That'll be fun. And this, to show you kind of the ridiculousness of the whole thing, it was a ribbon snake and a diamondback garter snake. I remember this vividly. I put them in the bag. My mom was, you know, I was so young, my mom was driving me up to the airport. And I had gone, so this is all pre-2001, had gone and put on the hooded sweatshirt, and I just put them in a bag, same bag together, and stuffed it into the, you know, front pouch of the hooded sweatshirt. And thought, I'm good to go. I'm wearing sandals, shorts, a T-shirt, my sweatshirt, you know, and a hat, right? I'm just going to walk through the little metal detector, you know, keep them on me to get through the metal detector, then I can put them back in my backpack, and just no worries at all. So I did. And my mom, you know, credit to her, I think this is, you know, parents for sure. She definitely knew I was up to something, but she was just like, whatever, it's fine. You know, I'm not going to push it. But he had the knowing look on his face that something was going down. Anyway, so I had this flight from Chicago to London, so Denver to Chicago to London, and then a long way over in London at Heathrow, and then a short flight over to Brussels. And so, you know, I check on him. I'm kind of feeling around. I put him in the backpack. It's an overnight flight, so we get to Chicago, and it's getting late-ish. Go to the bathroom, open up the bag. They're good. No worries. So I put him back. Good to go. Get on the plane, and we're going over the water, and now it's getting dark. Cabin lights have been dimmed, all this stuff. We've already had supper. And I'm on the window seat, okay? And then there's an opening next to me. I think this is 7... I don't know. I don't know the planes anymore, but it's the one where there's 3 against the window, then there's 4 or 5 in the middle, and 3 against the window on the other side. And so there's no one directly to my left. And then on the aisle seat of this, kind of by the window side, there's this German guy, doesn't speak a lick of English. So, you know, uneventful for the most part. Then midway through the flight, so we're over the Atlantic at this point, you know, I feel in the bag, and it feels a little bit light. So I, you know, get up a little worried, go to the bathroom. And sure enough, only the Diamondback's in there. That Ribbon Snake is no longer in tow. He was in there when I got on the plane. He is no longer contained. So that was a little bit disconcerting, as you can imagine. And, you know, half of that is just me sitting there going, well, shit, you know, if they find it, which seems relatively likely, we have 4 or 5 more hours on this plane, you know, presumably they'll associate the one with the guy who's, you know, standing there holding another one. But at this point, you know, youth is my guide, if nothing else. I decided I was going to stick it out. I didn't want it to be all for loss, so I didn't flush him. I held on to him. And I go back to my seat, and now I'm just like, you know, panicked like you can imagine. And just kind of watching the seconds, literally the seconds tick by and thinking, oh, this might not have been a great idea. The damn Ribbon Snake's going to send me to jail. And fortunately, I think eventually I pass out. So that when I wake up, because I remember this part vividly too, I wake up and the headrest in front of each seat has a little monitor with the little airplane showing you on the map where you're at. And we're about 40 minutes from landing. And I'm just watching. So I wake up. I'm like, okay, well, obviously no one has found it overnight because there would have just been screaming. I don't think I could possibly have slept through the, you know, panic that was from this whole thing. So I think we're good. We're legit. And I'm just watching this going, I think I'm going to make it. I think I'm going to make it. And this is right before the last call to go to the bathroom. And so they, you know, I think they had just given that saying, now this is your last chance. And then we're going to start the descent. So the lady in front of me, who I hadn't taken notice of, you know, the entire flight gets up, goes to the bathroom. And I'm just literally staring at the seat in front of me. And sure as shit, man, the thing's sitting on the armrest right in front of me, right next to the window.
Oh, my.
So I reach out and grab it and pull it down by my side. Oh, man, this musket is biting the shit out of me. And I've got it down by my side. And I have this false smile extended, you know, all the length across my face. And the German guy thinks I just stole it purse. So, you know, he's giving me the super stink eye. He can't express his feelings, but he's getting very agitated.
Right.
And I'm still biting the hell out of
him. Oh, my gosh.
And so she comes back and sits down, and there's no panic, and I think that eased him. It made him say, okay, this is fine, you know. He can't have just stolen her purse if she's not, you know, where the hell is my purse?
Right.
And so, you know, I get it back. He eventually stops staring at me. I get it back in the bag, put it in my backpack, blah, 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 no problem. Heathrow is, or was at the time at least, a very weird airport. If you're in the international terminal, it's very... where, at least where the flights land and you come in, it's like desolate. I mean, honestly, it looks like a municipal airport. It's very weird. But then what I didn't realize, if you kind of hop out of there and go somewhere else, I mean, it's an obviously modern airport. And as I said before, I had this long layover, like 4 or 5 hours, something like this. But, you know, I kind of while away the time and eventually get on the plane to Belgium, and I'm kind of relaxed at this point. Snakes are still in tow. This is all good. Get there, and because it was such a long layover, of course, they managed to lose the bag, so I have to wait an extra hour after I get off to explain to them where I'm going and what my address will be so they can send the bags 2 or 3 days later or whatever. So then my friends pick me up. We're driving back. I post Snakes Are In Sale. I show them, I think, the bag, and they're kind of, you know, bemused about the whole thing just upon initial sight, and then I start telling them. And they live outside of Antwerp, which is about an hour's drive from Brussels. And so we're driving, and the story itself takes about a half hour at the time, particularly because I'm still kind of in, you know, shock over the whole thing. And so then it's like, okay, well, the grand finale of my story is to open the bag and show them, and sure as shit, the damn ribbon thing's gone again.
Damn.
And so we search the car. It's not there.
Oh, my
God. We see the thing again. We were on, you know, driving vacation in France, like 2 weeks later, and it popped up through the clutch while we were on the highway. Fortunately, we didn't crash and die, but jeez. I was in the back seat, well out of reach to grab it, and, you know, neither of his parents was super, one, I think his dad was driving, and his mom was not super keen to grab this thing, so it went back down through the clutch and presumably wound up on the roadways of France, because they never saw it again.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, so that was kind of amusing, and so I survived that. Let me see, what else? After, kind of later on through high school, I started, so I was working at Bro Exotics, and then I started trying to buy animals from Cameron. I'm out here in Denver, and I tell you, it's very funny now, kind of the accessibility folks have, A, to his list, and B, to buying animals from him, because I tell you, he would dodge my calls and not return my calls for years
really?
And years and years. And you had to have a fax machine, I mean, well beyond kind of the normal life expectancy of fax machine, just because he didn't want people, you know, passing on his list, kind of like happens now with email. So he'd send these damn faxes. I know I had a fax machine for 5 or 6 years at whatever, $20 a month just to get for that purpose alone.
wow.
But anyways, you know, it's very funny, and eventually kind of Pro Exotics stopped doing a lot of the resale stuff. They stopped doing blood, stopped doing kind of volume of water monitors, doom rolls, you know, any of the stuff that they were getting through him, even, I guess, ball pythons and stuff occasionally, because they certainly were nowhere near into them, you know, 10 years ago as they were up to, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. Then, you know, at that point, I went to college. I went to Tulane for my freshman year, and couldn't really have any animals, you know, living in the dorm and stuff. I didn't pull an Owen, go, you know, all road reptiles. I did. I tried to, but my roomie was not having it, and so, you know, that was not going to work out. So I needed to move the stuff that I had taken and the stuff that I didn't take, you know, someplace, and I actually ended up teaming up with Tom Weaver, who's a great friend of mine, was the best man at my wedding, and is the supervisor at Tropical Discovery, which is the reptile or the herp section at Denver Zoo. At the time, he was a keeper, and now he's the supervisor of the area. And kind of, you know, after that rough, you know, it was just rough being away from the animals. Honestly, school was fine. A little bit expensive, I would say, and kind of recommend people, you know, go cheaper, I suppose. So I went to CSU, Colorado State, for my, you know, sophomore through senior years. And that whole time, man, Tom and I were buying and selling a lot of animals, you know, through cameras from other people, all this stuff. I think I told you, Eric, the other day that, like, what was that? I think it must have been 06, you know, to get just as a sense of scale, we sold, I think, $87,000 in animals, which is a lot.
Wow.
When, you know, we weren't selling high volume or high dollar animals at all. You know, our stuff, 1,000 max, more like, you know, kind of that 200 to 500 range. The bad part of that is that I think we cut Cameron probably cumulative checks for about 80, and then with expenses and stuff, we got up to 86 or 87. So it was good cash flow and a lot of fun, man. We saw a lot of cool animals, but, you know, I don't think we made, you know, actually, you know, secreted a dollar sort of thing. But it was really good fun, and I tell you, lots of cool stuff. And then after college, I worked at Pro Exotics again, doing rodents for the most part, and rodents and Asian rat snakes, and for a year and a half or so. Then I went to law school and kind of got to where I'm at now in a certain sense with a more limited collection of stuff that I really, really, really like. And actually, in a certain way, that was kind of my only time as a proprietor, because I would, when I was in law school, I would sell snakes to Barcheck. You know, I sold them cocci, rhinos, mandarins maybe, Vyontai, all this stuff. And it's like literally, you know, getting money from him that we, you know, the family used for supper and stuff, you know, so that was kind of interesting.
Wow.
And that's pretty much where we're at now, so.
Cool.
I hope that wasn't too boring.
No, no.
No, man. You're like the originator of snakes on a plane, dude.
I know, right? I'm telling you, man, when I was telling this story back in, like, 2002, I think that all predates that stuff. Certainly the first couple of years did. And I'm telling you, someone heard that story and said, let's make those fake snakes that, like, kill people within 5 seconds and add Samuel L. Jackson. It's in a much better story.
Yeah, man, you should call Sam L. and demand some of that money.
I know, right? And also, I guess I would throw this, you know, I jokingly mentioned, hey, why, you know, 20 grand for those occipitalis, a group of those occipitalis, maybe it's better to just go, you know, go get a ticket. I would say, you know, that's kind of my cautionary tale to anyone willing to do that. And then kind of as the, you know, aside, if you're not going to take the cautionary aspect of it, make sure your snake bank has seams that are tight enough. That was the flaw in my plan, was that ribbon snake was small enough to get between the bottom seams.
Wow.
That's crazy. So yeah, that's actually kind of a cool story, man. You know, you usually just hear the typical story of, you know, how people got into it. We were talking the other night and you told me you had a pretty cool story. You weren't kidding. So, cool stuff. So I know you're working with, I know you kind of went through all the different stuff that you work with, but what's kind of like where you're at right now as far as, like, you know, what your collection consists of and size wise and stuff like that? Like,
right on. At this point, for the most part, I've got rhino rat snakes, bear eye, the little variable kings, some Omahas, pygmy pythons that are available, womas that are available, a few chondros that are available, one badass super giant leopard gecko that eats these 4-inch locusts that I catch in the backyard. and then these cool undescribed monitors, and then we have a couple pancake tortoises that are my wife's, really, but they're in the trap downstairs, so, you know, I guess they count my stuff too. But
okay, cool. Yeah, we'll have to maybe talk a little bit about the monitors as we dial down through the stuff. But I think the one that excites me the most, of course, is the Halmahera scrubs. So, like, what, you know, there's not a whole lot of info out there on them. You know, people really, oh, wait a minute. I'm getting something over here that says, oh, shit. Anyway. I'm getting messages and stuff as I can't pay attention. I got to click off that screen. All right. Sorry. As far as Halmaharas go, like, you know, what's your thoughts on these guys? You know, how are you getting them in? And, you know, just a species that's never been bred in captivity, what's your approach and what's your thoughts? And give us the run.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my initial exposure to, I'd seen, really, I think they fall into that group that hasn't been written about a ton. I know we had talked the other day about the Barker description paper, and that's probably pretty close to it, because, I mean, there, you know, there hasn't been kind of an all-encompassing Indo-Python book that I'm aware of from anybody. It's supposed to have been in the works from the Barkers for a decade or whatever, and then I think they changed it up to be Bloods would be the third one that they would do and this stuff. And I understand why. I think that's, you know, probably more commercially viable and whatever.
Right.
But, you know, and easier, to be honest. but, like, you know, I think, so I had seen, I used to really dig there. They have two, had or have two sections of their site that I thought were really cool. The one I think was the Breeders Showcase sort of deal, where you could post and show off your cool stuff. And then the other was the Mailbag, which I thought was like, and they may or may not still do it, I don't know. But, you know, at the time, that's such, particularly Dave, man, that guy's a treasure trove of information, you know, and I think he's pretty honest and straightforward, and there's not a ton of, you know, kind of commercial aspect to what he's saying. He'll say it like he feels it. And so I think that really reading the two or three maybe entries that they had talked about, those was pretty much it. So maybe that's my either the secret to success or the problem or whatever is, you know, I hadn't really read anything about them. You know, I had some general idea, and that was about it. And I remember the first time, like, you know, it's funny that this obscure stuff, I still think they fit into that box, this obscure stuff, it comes, you know, comes and goes in waves, both in terms of availability and in terms of folks buying it. I mean, I remember the first ones I got either 1.3 or 1.4 from Cameron that, you know, he essentially gave me because he'd had them for like 6 months and no one would buy them. So whatever I got them for was just, you know, nothing relative to what they've been on that list for. And, you know, I just thought, okay, well, this is cool, you know, the only species that's never been bred, as you say, or so the line is, you know, and I thought, well, this is pretty cool. And, you know, I brought him home, and partially, I think, because he had had them for 6 months or whatever, you know, they'd been eating and stuff, so it was, you know, really no trouble at all, and I kept them kind of how we were keeping all our stuff, which is, I guess, similar to what I do now. In all my setups, I've never had the luxury of creating kind of this, you know, heated room, kind of the Terry deal or Tracy deal, or, you know, I guess even you, Eric, you have a pretty tightly controlled room. You know, mine's always been open basements, and I'm out here in Colorado, or even, you know, rooms, but rooms in a house that I don't have an independent heating and cooling unit on, or even, you know, those oil field heaters kind of weird me out a little bit, or scare me, as, you know. Tom had a fire right before I had moved my stuff over there. He'd had a fire and, you know, burned out his basement. And so he's always kind of been that way, and then seeing the Pro Exotics thing a couple of years ago firsthand, you know, that morning, you know, left me with the same impression. I'm kind of a low guy for sure. You know, low watts on everything, low electricity. And so I think I always kept them cooler than most. And everyone said, these things die, they roll, you know, within, you know, whatever, you're walking along one day and they just roll. And I think that may have been true really early on, maybe like late 90s. But I don't think it was, I think then it just became kind of the stigma, you know, in the same way that all blood pythons are mean, and, you know, hell, even carpets are mean, or carpets get huge, you know, that was the one, I remember that, you know, like, man, they all get the size of these humongous coastals that actually I've, you know, never seen in the U.S., but that was what they were, quote, all supposed to do, and all this stuff, you know, so I think that's some aspect of it. And I will say that I did take a pretty nasty bite from one of them, an unintentional bite, but a nasty bite nonetheless. I've been pulling them out. I don't think this was right when we got them, the day we got them. It might have been. I was pulling them out of the bag, and it didn't, you know, it wasn't a strike sort of situation. As I say, they're relatively calm, and I think when you keep them at what I think are appropriate temperatures, they actually are calm, for the most part. Obviously, individuals, you know, exist or whatever, but... he was going around my, so I'm pulling him out of the bag, he's going around my neck, and he accidentally catches a tooth in the back of my head, and ouch. That causes him to go into a full-on feed.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, I mean, so he, you know, he was a solid 6 or 7 foot snake, and, you know, scrubs are pretty strong, and he had teeth in there and stuff, and, you know, he wasn't a young animal, clearly, and so, yeah, so I felt that one, and, you know, in all honesty, I think that was about 10 years ago. And in all of the time, then, I think that's the only one I remember vividly. And perhaps, you know, I think I've had about 24 of them, including the ones I have now, over that time.
Yeah.
You know, and as kind of as a, you know, to play it safe, I'll say, you know, maybe I've taken a couple more bites since then. Certainly when I got some small ones back in 05, they wanted to, but I don't remember them landing anything. But for the most part, I think they're relatively calm, and the whole, you know, death thing, I think, you know, it all ebbs and flows, right, with what collectors are on what islands over there and all this stuff and, you know, kind of how long it takes things to get from A to B. And I think all that may at one point have been worse than it is now, you know.
Right.
So maybe there is some truth to kidney failure and all this stuff. Certainly I trust, you know, Yasser to have, you know, if he had him and he said his died randomly, I trust that that's what happened, and B, that he was doing a good job with them and it wasn't, you know, it wasn't his fault. So obviously there's some truth to it, but I can say that in the time I've been keeping them, which has been, you know, off and on over the last 10 years, honestly, I think, you know, knock on wood here, I'm hitting my elbow into the wood, you know, I think really it's been, I can't think of any that I've seen dead, you know, out of those 24. And a lot of that time, you know, we were cleaning them up and telling them and stuff, so there's some aspect of it that I wouldn't see, but really, I mean, nothing like, you know, what's commonly said of, you know, as you know, Eric, I love the show, so I hear, you know, when Chris was on or Blake's on, that, you know, it's one of these things where, like, oh, what's your advice for a starter's grow? Well, don't do home horrors, and then maybe don't even do cans and stuff. You know, I've always kind of felt like, actually, I think they're pretty calm. They're not huge. You know, as opposed to, you know, facing off with one of those versus a Barnack, I think I'll take my home any day of the week, dude. Both of them are caring, bleeding.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny, like, my thought process has kind of changed. We talked about this the other night, but over the years, my thought process has kind of changed that I just don't understand why a Halmahera python would be any different than any other type of python. I mean, regardless of whatever the environment is, or, you know, I've known that I've heard people talk about the environment and that it's constantly raining there and that it's 90 to 100 degrees and it's just like you're in constant moisture and, you know, this is what they need. And I just don't see why they would be different, though. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense to me. So I kind of followed your approach, and I'm kind of the same way, as that I don't really keep them any different. My thought is that, you know, it's actually funny that you brought up the VPI mailbag. I had Googled Halmahera scrub, and there was a picture of the one, which is beautiful, by the way, that they have
sure.
over on their site. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. That thing is freaking is amazing. But, you know, Dave had somebody had, and this was back in 2006, I think, that somebody had sent an email that they had acquired some, and that they were looking to figure out if there was any secret to breeding them. And Dave had just more or less chimed in and said that, number one, it's hard to acclimate a wild-caught female. So try to get, you know, the smaller the better. You're looking at probably 7 to 10 years for her to acclimate to captivity. And when she finally is, you know, then you may have success. What's your thought? I mean, for you keeping them for as long as – have you seen them do any kind of breeding activity in your group at all? Have you seen anything
honestly,
like that?
I've never really tried pairing them up.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's never been, you know.
Wait, what are you waiting for, dude? Right.
Yeah.
Or are you waiting
for a
long time? Like, what's your thoughts on for taking a long time to acclimate a female to captivity?
I think generally, you know, kind of more universally, I think that's pretty true. I would say kind of the flat statement that we hear that, like, you know, it's just not doable. Like, don't even buy them, which, you know, has been something of a party line among some folks for a few years. You know, I always laugh when those same people spend $35,000 on an adult female of X. I don't want to get into it, but it's like, okay, if you really thought that was true, I don't think you would have spent that money, you know, unless you just, you know, feel like giving it away. So I think there's yes and no. you know what I mean? And I think that's, hey man, more than, you know, if there's a theme to me, it's that, you know, nothing's black and white, everything's shades of gray. So I certainly respect the idea. And I think that's true, but, you know, at the same time, I think, well, as I say, I think the, you know, money speaks louder than words on that one, you know, so it's certainly doable. But with the high stress stuff, the white lips, the scrubs, I suppose ring pythons, you know, all this stuff, you know, and I know the legality of that, but just tossing it out there, you know, all that stuff, I think it's probably more than like a blood python, say. But at the
okay.
same time, like, I think 7 to 10 years is probably an overstatement, but at the same time, I, you know, and I think Rico said this when he was on too, at the same time, if you get them to go initially, it's going to be because, you know, they're going off their wild cycling, either whether they grab it or not, you know, they're just conditioned for it. Whereas if, you know, kind of you miss that window, then you're probably looking, you know, at least 2 or 3 years, which if, you know, babies were available, you conceivably could have a female that's getting towards maturity at that time. So,
right.
I don't know.
Okay. Now, I don't know. I don't know what your experience has been, but so far, I mean, once you get these guys going as far as feeding and such, I mean, mine are pretty rock solid. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think so too, and that's kind of the, you know, the surprise aspect of it. And, I mean, heck, you know, as with anything, you know, I could be proven the fool tomorrow. They could all roll tomorrow. I don't think so. It's possible. You know, I'm not, at the same time, I'm not a fundamentalist. You know what I mean? I'll admit that anything can be, you know, a little bit of X and a little bit of Y. But, I mean, heck, dude, I just keep them, we were talking about this, you know, I keep them in 28-quart tubs in terms of the adults. And I know that sounds small, but in reality, man, my, you know, that striped male, one of my, you know, favorite snakes, you know, he sits there, he coils up, and he'll wander around and stuff, but when, you know, when he's sitting coiled up there, man, he's sitting probably only over a quarter to a third of the tub's floor space.
Right.
You know, and so that is a non-arboreal setup, which I know is another thing we had talked about. But I tell you, man, I'm out here in Colorado, and with the relative humidity, what it is, to keep the temps high enough, I end up making these beef jerky makers, you know what I mean? Where, like, you know, it's got to be, because you still need good airflow, so you just end up like, yeah, I'm just dehydrating the heck out of the stuff. So my snakes will do better in a terrestrial setup with, you know, hey, I know Chris is a fan or has become a fan of cork bark. Me too, buddy. You know, me too. so it does have that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and it's funny, the, you know, the new female who's been captive for, I don't know, what, 9 or 10 weeks now or something like that, you know, she loves to sit on it. She's always sitting on it. So she's basically at the top of her tub, pressed against the, you know, pressed against the rack top and sitting there. And when she wants a mouse, you know, she moved her head to the front and said, hey, dude, toss me a mouse.
Right.
But, you know, the male, man, he never gets on his. He just sits on the floor happy as a clam and, you know, he's sleeping all the time. Every time I reach in there, he wakes up and goes, hey, what's going on, dude? You know, so.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah, I kind of agree. As we were having this conversation earlier, but, you know, do we keep the snakes in setups that we think the snake wants, or are we keeping the snake, you know, in a setup because it's what they need? So, for instance, I know, again, we go back to tubs, but, you know, Zach, you've seen my stuff and you've seen how it is, but my scrubs are in tubs, you know, and the reason I do that is because when I had them in, not in tubs, in caging, they really didn't do, you know, with the heat lamp over top, their sheds were horrible, granted, these weren't like high-end caging or anything like that, but still, I noticed the difference. So what I have right now, I put them in tubs and boom, right away, sheds were perfect. You know, they just seem to be healthier, if that makes sense. You know, just by looking at them, they seem to to be happier. The one thing I would recommend, I don't know about you, but I keep mine high up because I don't have them in a closed type of rack. Maybe that's what you have, Rob. You have them in like a closed type of rack. So
no,
I keep mine high.
I have them in the Vision, yeah, but anyway.
Okay. So I keep them high up so that they're looking down at me rather than me being on their level, because I noticed that when I kept them on their level, you'd hit that constant thump, you know, thump, thump, thump. It's trying to get at you. So I moved them up there, and then it stopped right away. So I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, mine are up high too, like kind of different reason, but, you know, who knows? Maybe it has the same purpose. I will say that with mine, you know, I'm using newspaper, and I always use, you know, sheets that are bigger than the tub. So mine, you know, honestly, they're, you know, the newspaper itself folds up so that it's like halfway to two-thirds of the way up the tub. So that probably
mm-hmm.
helps for one, you know, as part of it. And then I have them just because it's a little bit warmer. I don't run a ton of heat. You know, mine right now, it's probably in the mid-70s in my room. And I have them, so since it's a Vision rack, I have them on that heat cable stuff, and it's on a rheostat that's set so that it's one of these ZoomEd rheostats so that you turn it on, and to turn it on, you actually have to go fairly far, and then I just bring it back all the way until it, like, right before it's going to shut off.
Okay.
So that it's,
gotcha.
At this time of year, it's probably, as I say, it's, you know, variable in the 70s, up to probably 76 or so. It's getting really hot. And then they have heat cable kind of around the outsides of the tub that gets them maybe to, I would say, the mid to low 80s, you know, something like that, in that part, you know, if they're sitting on it. I will say, more than other stuff, they do certainly sit on it, but they do all their functions just great at that level. I think kind of, you know, fitting into Terry's idea, you know, Terry's idea doesn't work for me because I can't do that flat line 78 to 82. That's out for me.
Right.
You know, and frankly, it doesn't work for a lot of the other stuff that I keep, or for me, or just my heating cooler, any of that stuff. And I don't think that makes sense. But in terms of the temperature range, I think he's right. But mine, that means that, like, you know, now it's in my room, generally is in the 70s. But heck, man, in January, those tubs on the, you know, front of those tubs or the middle of those tubs, they're going to be in the 60s. You know, that little, you know, that real little mail home that I'd gotten in October or so that Cam thought was the smallest one ever. And I said, hey, dude, what about those couple I bought back in 05 that he
didn't
remember?
Yep.
You know, either way, man, I tell you what, this past winter, it would be literally low 60s, and he's sitting all the way at the front, those Vision hatchling tub, he's sitting all the way at the front, 15 inches away from that heat, and he's saying, give me a mouse, dude. Just give me a mouse. And, you know, toss it in there, and he nails the hell out of it. You know, and then he'll go sit on that heat for a few days. But then, sure enough, you know, I think we don't, I forget who it was that was saying we don't let him do, you know, let them be ectotherms, let them do what they're supposed to do. But I agree.
Right.
You know, I think we're so afraid of what other people will think that we don't, like, trust our things.
Yeah. That's a good
statement. You know what I mean? Like,
I might have to put that in the Hall of Fame quote. The Moralia Python Radio Archive quote. I like that one. But you're absolutely right, man. You know, I mean, I think that if you're paying attention to your snake, I think that they're going to tell you what they want, you know. Yeah, that's just that simple. What's your thoughts on, you know, as far as actually, let's back up for a second. Maybe you can give some tips or suggestions on, obviously, if you're working with this species or thinking about working with this species or kind of scrubs or anything over from Indonesia, Papua New Guinea type of stuff, you're probably going to be working with wild caught stuff. What's your suggestions for getting them going in captivity? Are you deworming them? What are you doing? What's your thoughts?
I mean, in terms of, it's certainly, I mean, you know, in those years that we spent doing it, you know, in volume, you know, every couple weeks, you know, every 2 weeks, Cameron get one from Guyana, Suriname, or Indonesia. And we're out there with Ryan, who I think you met at ICAST, you know, and Cameron, and, you know, having some beers and, you know, getting some cool animals. I remember I got a, you know, little bicolored annulated boa that was both orange and, you know, orange and gray. One kind animal that now, because it's still one of a kind, I know where it's at now. What's the guy's name? Jeffrey in Tennessee. He does a lot of, you know, rare boas and stuff. I know he's got, I think, Jamaicans and a lot of the Epicrates. Certainly kind of that guy. You know, I think he bred the Puerto Rican boas, the Inornatus, which are CITES 1.
Oh, man.
Yes. Yeah,
you have a piece of my heart right there. Puerto Rican boas.
Yeah, right. I mean, wish. And that, honestly, this will diverge for a second, but, I mean, that goes back all that way, and this where I think it's important, or I think it's sad that people are, you know, getting, the sad thing to me about the ball python thing is that you're just reading, like, websites. You know, I don't have a great website. I have some cool pictures, because I think that's what people really like. But, you know, I should have more info there. And even as such, I think maybe part of the reason I don't, though it doesn't really fit with this species, it's just my cop-out, you know, is to encourage people to actually look in the literature for themselves, even if it's just, you know, frankly, Applegate talking about, you know, commercial breeding, you know, from his papers in the early 80s. I mean, that shit blows me away. You know what I mean? Like, just when you think of that in time and scope. And I think that matters, and that we need to, you need to have kind of a rounded view, not just, you know, Ralph Davis's ball python breeding record is your Bible. As a Bible, you know, nothing against Ralph, but if that's your Bible, that's pretty sorry, or at least suggest that you're not, you know, I know Eric and I, man, we're obsessed with reptiles. You know, these ball python people, I think you like ball pythons, you know, as opposed to being, man, I tell you what, if I could channel, like, my obsession with reptiles into something that actually, like, you know, made me money or something, it would be unbelievable. You know?
No shit.
But
yeah, I think
anyway. Yeah. So I guess where the initial diversion there was, I remember Puerto Rican boas showing up in one of those reptiles magazines from like 98, something like that, and it's eating a bat.
Wow.
And I was just like, that's badass. And then I saw nothing of them for the next like 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I know Jeff has them, Crutchfield had some. I mean, they're cool little critters. And I think those are genuinely cool, not just cool because they're rare, would be my guess.
Yeah, they're herping in Puerto Rico. I am Puerto Rican, so, like, being in their country and trying to find them, and, you know, they're really a special animal to me. And I would always, my dream is to be able to work with them one day. And so, like, every time I hear somebody talking about them, I'm like, my ears are, like, wide open. I'm, you know, I just, they're the coolest, man. They are definitely the coolest. I mean, to hang around caves and snatch bats right out, awesome. Like, just such a cool snake. And, you know, part of my natural heritage, you know, and everything. So it has a special place in my heart, those snakes. And it's a shame that, you know, in the country they're being, you know, killed off and their population is almost nothing. You know, what are they, CITES 1 at this point? You know, I know that Tom produced them last year, but, you know, I would love to get some, but of course, you can't sell them outside of Florida. And, you know, that's kind of, that kind of sucks, you know, unless you have some special permit or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some aspect with the permit, and also I think it kind of comes down to how you read the endangered species. I mean, so there are CITES 1, and that's what we all say, right? But just as a clarification, not on you, but just as general knowledge, we all say CITES 1 as though that's the important thing, and it is in terms of importation. But once we're in the U.S., it's this Endangered Species Act that controls, and that's what keeps us from shipping across state boundaries. And actually, I would argue that there's, you know, suggest that a close reading of that is far looser in terms of movement than, you know, kind of the way we as a community have chosen to view it. And I understand that. There's, you know, I understand my background as, you know, a lawyer makes me view the law in a little bit different, you know, with a critical eye to see, you know, and I'm certainly not, this is no recommendation. It's not legal advice. I'm just saying that I think my legal advice would be that people should read it closely. That's my legal advice.
Okay.
My free,
and find,
you know,
the loophole.
So, you know, that is what it is. But just as a, you know, just tossing it out there sort of thing. So.
Okay.
So getting back to, I think, where we started before I
started
tumbling off the cliff. in terms of, like, acclimating wild stuff and whatever, I will agree that, like, man, the smaller you can get stuff, the better, for sure. No one loves Captain Hatch more than me, although I really hope, you know, and obviously it's not viable, some of the stuff, you know, that's coming from far away, but that they're genuinely releasing those females. Because if they're not, it's really a sad thing. You know, I had seen, I don't remember if it was Mark O'Shea or if it was Brian, you know, Brian Fry, who had posted, no, I think it was Daniel Bennett, right, the monitor guy, who runs Man Bam, you know, saying that really, like, you know, indigenous cultures and stuff respect the, you know, gravid female, you know, above all. If there's any kind of anything, you know, sacred, that's what will be left. And I really hope that we're not just, you know, it's not kind of all lip service. You know what I mean? And I really don't have a great handle on that. I know that's what we all say. And I certainly, all I'm saying is I hope that's legit, you know. And certainly, reptiles have shown some resilience. You know, I was reading the Carl Kaufeld Snakes and Snake Hunting a couple months ago, you know, and I'm reading this thing, and it's just like, man, the numbers of snakes that he and others talk about pulling out of these different locations, it boggles my mind, you know, in the way that I think, oh, if I take, you know, even a pair of snakes from a given place, maybe I'm, you know, on a super local level having a serious impact. And they're talking about in a given day ripping out 40 or 50 of these things back in the 50s. And it's like, well, apparently they just have the ability to populate areas.
Right.
You know, still exist in some extent, you know, or at least they did until 20 years ago or 10 years ago, until it was really habitat development, you know, overdevelopment or whatever that was the problem. You know, so maybe that's part of it too. But, you know, getting off the soapbox for a second, the smaller you can get, the better. Captive hatched, you know, certainly the babies, I think, are the closest, you know, closest thing in terms of just adapting to what you're trying to do. And I think that's really the key with acclimating anything. You know, heck, I have these wild monitors now. And really, I think you just need to be big enough, you know, be secure enough in what you're doing to let them do what they need to do. And that, you know, frequently involves, I think I told you, Eric, like, you know, that female home. Honestly, I put the water at the front of the tub and, you know, would check the water every, you know, 4 or 5 days or something like that. And other than that, I literally didn't touch that snake for like 5 weeks.
Right.
You know, and that is, you know, and she pretty much sat in the same spot that entire time. And I think that's the first step, you know.
Right.
And you need, and it's hard when you have, it's the reason that wild-caught snakes frequently die when they go to, you know, individuals where it's their only snake. Is because when it's your only snake, man, you're so jazzed about it that you want to be scared of this thing. I know how that is.
That's
great, but it's not great for the, you know, for that animal. And that animal will suffer, and that's why kind of the, you know, go captive bred and the stuff. Hey, man, I'm all for supporting captive breeding, but I think a lot of that discussion is really kind of focused on, well, A, and maybe it's just a, you know, kind of a value-based decision. I won't ignore that aspect of it, but the other part of it, I think, is kind of aimed at folks who are just starting. And there's a really important place for, you know, providing that info. But at some point, you know, once you have the tool bag, right, to be able to make your own good decision, I think then you can start working with some of that stuff successfully. And the keys would be to, you know, leave it alone. And that includes meds, man. Honestly, most of those internal parasites are going to run their course in about a year. And if we take the long view on stuff and you just are willing to, I mean, in all honesty, kind of, you know, leave it be beyond the maintenance stuff for that entire time, you know, then you'll be fine and it'll run out. I've, you know, I have wild rhino rat snakes that, man, I didn't put a drop of meds into those at all. And they're now, you know, it's 8 years later and they're doing great. They're 4.5 foot long, you know, produced literally hundreds of babies for, you know, like no worries whatsoever.
Right.
And I think a large part of that is not, you know, not stressing them out. And I think some of that does come from, you know, learning at the, you know, foot of the mailbag, you know, of Dave at the mailbag. You know, I know wild mandarins, man, those just die. And Wollendorf I are the same way. And, you know, his advice, someone, you know, he said, don't do it. Hey, my advice for working with wild, or, you know, acclimating wild mandarins, don't buy them in the first place. They're going to die. But
well,
advice part B would be, if you do get them, you know, set them up. Don't touch them for a month. Do, you know, do what I just talked about and don't even touch them. And don't even literally touch them with a snake hook. Bend like, a, you know, a metal coat hanger out so that literally you have no contact whatsoever with this thing. I mean, there's minimal points of contact, all this stuff. I've tried that and mine still die. But I think for most other stuff, it's, you know, it's okay. And
right.
You don't even need to go that far. And if your animal, like that little Halmahera male, you know, if your animal tells you, hey, man, you know, you could take me further, or those tannin bars that I sold to Ben, you know, that pattern xanthic animal, you know, that thing, it was just an awesome animal. And, you know, when that's the case, run with it, man. If the thing's cool, you don't need to leave it alone for a year if it clearly isn't bothered by the fact that you're, you know, that you have it out, that you're checking it out, that you're thinking, this thing's the shit.
Right. Right.
The exception would be external parasites, obviously. So kind of the parasite thing that's internal, I should clarify. And if you really did want to met them, then I would get them solid on food and then kind of put some panicure into your food item and go that way. But in terms of, like, externals, yeah, you got to get rid of that stuff, man. That's nothing worse. And I think, you know, just as a bloodborne pathogens and stuff, that's really nasty stuff. So, you know, those you do need to get rid of, unfortunately. In my opinion, Black Knight was the product. You know, great product that you could actually spray actively, you know, on snakes, no issues whatsoever. You know, I think maybe a super little, like a Thera or a Western Hognose or some, or a house snake might have some issues out of that. But, you know, that stuff kills mites dead and, you know, leaves you with a living snake. I actually tried that with a beautiful, beautiful high yellow Biak Chondra that I'd gotten from Cameron, about yearling size, which Daniel would tell you was wild caught. I think it probably was. But kind of neither here nor there. This thing was absolutely freaking gorgeous. And so I didn't really realize that Preventamite wasn't something you could do that with. And, you know, so I sprayed it direct in the same way that I would use, you know, Black Knight. And, man, that thing was doing curlicues. It ended up coming around. And I gave it to a friend of mine, but, you know, it was a very clear lesson learned for me. And, you know, it made me very frustrated then that Bob Pound, the owner of Preventamite, went out of his way to get Black Knight, you know, out of our hands so that he could push his product, which I feel is inferior. That's just my opinion. It's not a, you know, take for what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
I've never used Black Knight, so I have no experience with that, but wow, you could just spray it right on the snake.
Yeah, I still have a couple cans. You best I still use it.
Wow.
You know, they're leftover cans. You can't buy the stuff, but yeah. And unfortunately, you know, I mean, it is what it is. But mine are, you know, years old, and it's still
works.
Get it, and you know, I've had nothing but success. So that's all I can really say to that.
Okay. All right. So basically, the external parasites. Get rid of those internal parasites, not so much to worry about.
As long as they're
probably
eating and stuff and they're not looking bad. You know what I mean? Like,
Right.
If, they,
you know,
yeah,
if they're shit in blood, you're in trouble. Gotcha.
Right. Then I think you have that, you know, that need to be addressed. But generally speaking, if you're, you know, if their stools look and smell, you know, obviously they're not going to smell great, but if they, you know, if they're not just a mess. You know the difference. You guys both
have
well enough
gotcha.
Stuff that you know exactly what I mean. And I'm sure everyone, you know, foolish enough to listen will agree, you know, will note, you know what I mean. So.
Yep.
Have you worked with, you were just talking about tannin bars. Have you worked with other scrub species?
Not really a ton. I did get those first. I think maybe Ryan Young had bred them at that point. I don't know who else was kind of in that first, you know, first two or three or four breedings of them. But when I got them in, Cameron got some, the little captive bred and Indo babies in 2006, I think. Those were the, you know, I got all these little apparently gold patterned, mostly patternless, animals that were just, you know, just gorgeous. And they were just, you know,
right,
newborns and just shipped over or whatever. And those were the only ones kind of that size I had seen, you know, up until that point. It was very funny because there was, I think, interest in those, but I had, you know, paid Cameron a pretty penny for those things. And it was very funny because, you know, kind of getting into the market stuff, I suppose, at Touch. You know, I paid him a lot for those, and there was one person, Rolf Kern, who was interested in paying, you know, even a bit more than that for me, and he bought the pair within, I think, 10 minutes of posting an ad on MP, you know, back in 06.
Right.
And the other five, literally, I didn't even get a call about. It was very funny. So I had those little guys for a while. And that was very cool because, as I say, I'm telling you, at that time, they really, really weren't around, and that was the first year that they had produced them. So that, you know, it was a new thing. I haven't really done a ton of other scrubs. I think they're very cool, but I have a ton of respect for Barnex. You know, and even Southerns, but especially Barnex. I mean, those critters are apex predators, and not that Papuan pythons and, you know, honestly, those are probably more dangerous in a certain way, except they don't really bite, they punch you, which is pretty funny. but, like, you know, I just, you know, I have a ton of respect for those, and I think that's been something that I've always kind of, you know, I've sold to Luazi Retics and stuff, and that's, and I've sold, what else kind of fits into that same box where I thought, you know, this, I don't feel super about this. This isn't it. Oh, well, here's one. I sold little, you know, captive hatch croc monitor, which is an amazing animal. Very smart, never bit me, absolutely gorgeous. But, you know, it freaked me out and left me saying, really, there's no one I can sell this animal to reasonably. In fact,
right.
I was there for the dissection of, so Denver had, I guess they had, so they had a pair plus an extra female or something like that. You know, and I was there, so I interned there, and when I was there one Sunday, the male had eventually died. They actually did produce three or four good clutches of those. Got the eggs hatched out, beautiful little babies. I think sent them to other zoos. But the, you know, this male had passed away, and man, he was beat to hell. The female just kicked the crap out of this thing, you know, just continually, not as kind of the cause of death, but just continually. And he actually, he's laying on the table, and I tell you, man, I just had this feeling like, okay, this is the, you know, scene in the Alien movie where the thing, you know, wakes up as they're about to chop into it with the damn saw, you know, and then it just, you know, goes berserk, kills the entire room and escapes, right? But everyone's just, you know, you see the splatter of blood across the front window, you know, of the room or whatever. I mean, that's, and the female was bigger, you know, and that was the feeling.
Oh,
and
wow.
Honestly, it was profound, and it left me saying, you know, wow. I mean, really, this is, it's a ton of respect, a ton of admiration, and also a ton of, yeah, I probably, you know, should have gotten this sense from that little 18-inch one I was holding. That, like, you know, they're an apex predator for a reason. And, you know, it's, you know, it's our good fortune that they really don't punish us a lot, you know, as the broader community.
Right. Wow. There is a question, not to jump off topic, but the question was, let me pull it up here real quick so I can read it. It's from Brian C., and he was talking about when we were talking about internal parasites And he said, don't worry about keeping your animals to possibly carry internal parasites near your animals that don't. So basically, I mean, would you keep them in kind of an extended quarantine away from everything else? So basically he's wondering, that year that you're saying that they'll kind of work out, are you keeping them away from the rest of your collection during that time?
I think kind of yes and no. I think the quarantine thing is kind of a mixed bag. Most of us, you know, really aren't set up to do what really would be quarantine, which would really be not working these same animals in the same day and, you know, kind of having them well separate, all different tools, you know, kind of a serious scrub down between, you know, working one versus the other and stuff. And it's just not really practical for most of us. So I think when we say quarantine, you know, that's kind of the connotation, but in reality it's a lot looser than that for most people. And if you can, I mean, heck, dude, if you can do like a bleached foot bath, stuff that they do out at the zoo, you know, they have a, you know, separate, you know, it's a separate door. You have to go through the bleached foot bath to go in there and stuff. So I've been exposed to all that stuff, what an actual quarantine looks like. And if you can do that, man, that's awesome. You know, that's great. I would say generally, you know, one thing, I wouldn't go tossing it in with another animal. If you weren't 100% certain that that thing's clear, I wouldn't put it in with another, you know, clear captive animal. If you had, you know, an emerald, you know, you had your beautiful female emerald, right, that you'd raised up from one of these little orange babies Cameron gets or whatever, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years down the road, and then he brings in, you know, an anaconda phase adult male, and you say, hell, I just want to toss him in, that would be a bad idea. I wouldn't do that. And I think that's kind of the most important thing. And I think external parasites are kind of the other really, really important thing in that regard. The other thing I would say is, and it's kind of, in a certain way, is the negative, less, well, not with Cameron, but with, you know, folks who are buying from him and reselling, is I think the nastiest bugs, both in terms of kind of, you know, internal, like viruses and stuff versus actual parasites and things, come from cross-contamination, you know, amongst species or amongst species from different areas. You know I had been lined up to get some, you know, adult wild-caught rhinos from someone else. You know, not, I guess it would have been the kind of the same source out of China, but through someone that wasn't Cameron. And I paid the money and everything, and then it was, oh, they died, which really surprised me because, you know, I bought 7 of those things back in 2005 from Cameron as all, well, the one of the two females was smaller, slightly smaller, green, but slightly smaller. And all of those did great, which was a really big departure from, you know, basically the reputation of all wild Asian rat snakes. And, you know, so I was kind of like, what? And his response was, well, you know, one of my workers tossed him. We had some African species, you know, that was here and sold. And so, you know, it was a tub with aspen and stuff, and it still looked clean, so he just tossed them in. And they went downhill rapidly. And that may or may not be true. I don't know. Maybe he sold them to someone else. But who knows? But what I can say is the idea of it is certainly feasible to me. I do think that that's kind of where we really run into problems. So I guess, you know, in terms of worry for other stuff, I would be less worried about my other home Maharas and kind of more worried about if I had, you know, oh, I don't know, annulated boas right next to them or something like that.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah, he was just kind of, I guess I was reading the chat and it was more like, will the eternal parasites crawl out of a cage like a mite would or something and infect other cages and stuff like that? And from what I've been told from my vet and such, that eternal parasites are passed by, well, fecal matter. So as long as you keep make sure that snake and that cleaning is not, you're not doing that cleaning and then going with your dirty hands and going through other cages, generally you're going to be okay. But of course, having that animal outside the room is going to be safer all the way around anyway. You know what I mean? Just because
for sure. No, I agree, you know, 1,000%.
Right. But it's not safer if you're going to go and you handle that snake or change that cage and then going into your reptile room without washing your hands.
Right. Without doing what you need to do.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, yeah.
I know that sounds like common sense, but you would be surprised, you know? I mean, people think just because you have it outside the room that somehow that, like, you know, just, like, this is a barrier between whatever's outside the room and whatever this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not coming in. It's in the other room. So,
and I think, you know, the other thing that's important to mention, too, in terms of just, you know, in terms of good care, and it's, you know, I think this is something that's been pointed out as, you know, good husbandry technique, or avoiding a poor one, for, you know, literally since those early Applegate articles and stuff. Don't stick your thumb in the water in the bowl and then do the same thing on the next bowl. You know, that's kind of I think, a classic thing that's easy to slip into, you know, a bad habit that's really easy to pick up. But, yeah, try not to do that.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess before we get off of Hal Mahara's, I know we've kind of been going back and forth and talking about this, but if you were to approach breeding, what would be your are you going to do anything different, or you know, are you cooling them down, or are you giving them a rain chamber, or you know, anything crazy, or you know, what's your thoughts? What?
No, honestly, man, I don't think that's the key. I mean, well, and here we can speak, you know, and I can only speak to the extent that he told me. I think this is, well, is this common knowledge? the Blake thing, the, you know, OKC thing? Does everyone know about that or no?
No. What?
Huh?
I don't know.
Okay. Okay, baby. Well, hell, I'm sure, you know, whatever. It's truth. Enough people know secretly, I'd imagine. I can't imagine he'll be upset at this. You know, his zoo had produced, got eggs this past year.
Oh, okay. Wow.
And it came, and the reason I bring it up is that it, you know, came out of kind of like just normal husbandry. I think he's not even working in that section anymore. It's like,
it's
the kids. It's, you know, he's off with the kid stuff, I think, or at least he was at the time. You know, and they just had these animals on display for 5 or 6 or 7 years. You know, and this is where I think it's instructive, you know, what he said and why, you know, I hope he's not upset that I tossed it out there. Like, the reason that he even became aware of it is that one of the keepers brought it to him and said, hey, can you help us force feed this female? She's not eating. And she was apparently, like, black. She had turned, like, black. And can you help us force feed this snake? And he looks at it and says, she's heavily gravid. I'm not going to help you fucking force feed this snake, you know?
Wow.
You're insane. Put that thing away, you know? Like, this is the answer. And so to me, I think that speaks to kind of what we, and I'm just as guilty as anyone, as private keepers often fail with, and that's we like to think, oh, I'll grow this, you know, X, Y, or Z snake up. You know, I'll maintain it the same way every day for, you know, years, literally 5, 6, 7 years. And for most of us, that's not practical. I mean, heck, dude, between, you know, over the last 5 years, I think I've lived 6 or 7 different places. You know what I mean? Like, and I know I'm getting into the point of my life where I'll probably be a little more sedentary, but I'm sure, Zach, you're either that way now or you will be, you know, in the next couple of years. And, like, the benefit that zoos have isn't necessarily, you know, being progressive or being able to implement new ideas or new techniques. In fact, a lot of the time they're kind of hamstrung by, you know, the bureaucracy away from doing that. I know Ari's talked about that, you know, and I see it with Tom and stuff. I know that's true, you know, for a fact.
Right.
But what they do have is it doesn't matter what happens in my life or your life, Eric, or your life, Zach. Like, the snakes are sitting in the same cage. Just, you know, until they die or they get surplused out. But, you know, for the most part, it's just like years and years of daily maintenance without issue, with no change, you know, such a routine. And I think that's what, when private keepers fail, I think that's a large part of the reason. You know, and you see a guy like Eugene, and that's why he has such success, is because he's literally, you know, got snakes and he's in the same area, you know, same place, and maintaining the same snakes in the same way for 35 years. That's a large part of it. And I think it's a large part of the reason why people who aren't, you know, kind of full-timers or just really committed or really sedentary or whatever, like, why we don't produce as much success. You know, I think that's certainly true. You know? Huh. And so my answer would be no. I would hope that I'm living in the same place and that, you know, I've kept them in the same tub and that they, you know, eat rats or eat mice. I don't feed them rats, actually. I don't feed anything rats, but I certainly don't feed them rats. I think it's too much for them. I mean, put it this way, my, you know, that striper male, you know, and he's been in captivity now for 5 years, more than 5 years, 5.5 years. And he was a full-blown big old adult, had to be, you know, 4, 5, 6 or more years old at the time. So, you know, that puts him at past 10 for sure. And, you know, I feed him a mouse every, you know, kind of when I feel like it. Every, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, if he's really looking at me, then, you know, and I tell you what, man, he looks great and feels great. And you know what that looks like and feels like, you know?
Sure.
But, you know, really, I think that's the key. Honestly, so as you know, Eric, I'm sending these two of those homes, the striper and then that female, off to Julie. And honestly, I already have kind of the seller's remorse on the whole darn thing. You know, I'm sitting there going, man, I really think she's going to hatch out some little stripers and I'm going to be really pissed. I told her, yeah, tell me back some.
There you go.
Oh,
that's when the price triples.
I know, right? Yeah, for sure. I know. I'll put it this way. With, you know, as good as I feel about that male, as good as I feel about her as a keeper, and as good as I feel about this female even, based on the size she came in at, how she fed the other night, all this stuff, like, man, I know that within 2, 3, 4 years, I fully expect to be paying her 3 times as much for one little baby as what she paid me for both of them.
Yeah. I think
I'd be shocked,
you know,
if that doesn't come to fruition.
I know it's good. I'm not saying it's a bad way, but we're kind of bouncing all over the place. But that brings me up a good point that I say a lot of times, and I'm even guilty of it myself, is that I think that in the hobby, a lot of people that they get excited about a project or they get excited about keeping a certain species or whatever, and then they get into breeding it. And we had kind of touched on this the other night when we were talking when I first got into this, I had no intentions of breeding at all. Like, that never even crossed my mind. Like, I didn't even care about it. You know, all I cared about was keeping them. You know, I just wanted to keep these cool reptiles and, you know, watch them in their cages and observe what they do and, you know, just having this little chunk of nature in my house type of thing. You know, that was kind of my mentality. But I see it a lot. And actually, I learned this from Reptile Radio way back in the day when I used to listen to that. And, you know, a lot of people would kind of shy away from that maybe because they're talking about ball pythons. But I learned a lot from those guys, and just the fact that, you know, I applied what they were talking about to what I was doing, even though I wasn't keeping ball pythons. It was just the idea. One of the biggest things that they always said, at least Larry always said, was the fact that if you're going to do a project, then stick with it, man. Stay with it. Don't get, you know, go off into like some other tangent or whatever. And I know we're all guilty of it, you know, but that's kind of like mm-hmm. right now, you know, you got to stay focused on what you're trying to do. And I think that people get in, you know, like, you know, they may get into scrub and they may try to work with a scrub or even a chondro or something like that, or, you know, and then they'd never even kept a snake before. And maybe something happens, or maybe they try to go a cheap route or something like that, and they get a wild caught and it doesn't do good. And then they have a bad taste in their mouth, and, you know, or, you know, maybe the fact that they just kind of like, you know, they out of the project. It's just that simple. Shoop, I'm out, you know, done, whatever. And they never have any success because, you know, people aren't keeping them long term. Yeah, and they just kind of bail on it because they don't see the project through. I mean, you got to think when you're purchasing, at least with a captive born and bred baby, you know, you're looking at three years maybe before, you know, with some of the Morelia that we're keeping, Zach, what is Chondro's? What? You're looking at what, 4 years, 5 years before you can even attempt to breed it? I mean, that's a lot of patience, man. That's a huge investment into a breeding project that you want to do, and I don't think that people think that through. So you see a lot of people flipping, you know, through projects, you know, because they're not finding. It's almost like people follow what other people tell them is cool rather than do what they think is cool, you know. And I know I'm kind of going off, but you know what I mean?
Not totally.
You know, and I think you're right. I think that's why people don't have success with those type of.
It's actually it's funny you said because Chuck was on what last week, and what he was saying is, you know, when he got a new project, he focused on it, and it was all about that project, and he cleaned house, so to speak, and he focused on it, and he bred Waggler Eye and you know the Temple Viper, and he was the first one to really do that successfully and do it year after year, and you know because he focused on his project and what he really wanted to do, and so I think. And if everybody did that, yeah, you're going to find, you know. That's why you see Mark having success with the bowling. That's what he does. He does bowling.
Yeah.
You know?
That's 20 years, so, man. That's a long time. but the guy stuck with it, you know, because he's passionate about the species that he want to work with. I mean, if he was into it because of the money or because of anything else, I guess he would have sold those bowlings a long time ago.
A long time ago, yeah.
You know what I mean? Screw this. I mean, because let's be honest, you're talking about a species that's not cheap to begin with, and then you're going to go and invest that type of money. I mean, you really are into that species, and you really want to keep it if you're going to do that, but... You know, I don't know, just kind of my thoughts. I know we're kind of going into, like, talking about the reptile business and all that kind of stuff. I don't know what your what's your thoughts, Rob? What do you think of that whole thing?
Yeah, no, I'm with you both completely. I mean, I think that's, you know, the one caveat, right, in terms of folks selling stuff or whatever is, you know, I'm all about trying different stuff, you know, to figure out. That thing with Chuck, yeah, that was fascinating, man. And what fascinated me more was that he had picked those individual things. He said, Waggler Eye, the Mandarin, now Kofia, like he just, like a deliberate choice. And perhaps in, you know, in actuality, that first, you know, 6 months or a year wasn't as neat in terms of, well, what am I going to do next or whatever. But, you know, certainly either way, it was like, wow, dude, that's pretty impressive. Because most of us, I know I, you know, as I said at the beginning or medium or whatever, you know, right now I have pygmy pythons, womas, green trees, all stuff that I think on all those, not the pygmies, those were a couple of years ago, but, you know, in terms of the other stuff, that's all stuff that I've gotten within the last 12 months, principally based on, well, hey, they've been things of interest to me, but, you know, falling into that, I see beautiful, you know, Ryan sure gets some, and pick some beautiful chondras from Cameron. You know what I mean? At every Colorado show, which is between the two of them like six times a year, I'm staring at those damn things, and it's like, yeah, sure, dude, I'll trade you some lights for those and whatever. You know, and that's, you know, that's kind of the way it's worked. And that's cool. They're super cool animals, but I think part of that is figuring out, okay, other people like it doesn't necessarily mean it's my thing. And I think the good thing that both, you know, going back to Larry and BT especially too, it's like, yeah, both of them were all about you need to stick with your project, but make sure it's something that you want to stick with. You know what I mean? When you find the things that you want, you stick with those things. But if it's something that you don't, if you're not feeling it, then just, I think the mistake people make, in my opinion, this is certainly getting into the reptile business aspect of the stuff, would be, If there's something that you have that you're not really thrilled with, that you're taking care of and stuff, especially if it's something you didn't produce because there's an, you know, affiliation, a feeling of affection there just because you produced it, especially if it's something you didn't produce, man, honestly, you know, take what you can get and move on with your life. It's better for you and the animal. You know, if it's, if you're not about it, move forward. You know, that's kind of the caveat to all that. Keep it long enough to know if it's your thing. If it's not your thing, man, don't haggle for $50. You know what I mean? Like, and I'm not talking like, okay, well, supposedly they're worth $2,500 and you sell them for $250. You know, I'm not talking about that. But I'm saying, like, if I think, you know, I want, you know, $500 and the guy says $400, you know, and it's, you know, that day at a show and I don't like them, dude, I can tell you, you know, dollars for donuts, I'm taking
you
that $400. You know, like, that's, you know, but at the same time, if I really like it, the answer is no. And the answer might be, whatever, dude, now it's $600. You know what I mean? Like, so I feel that too. It's just a function of saying, I really think the mistake we make as keepers that I certainly have made over and over and over myself is, you know, more isn't better necessarily. And, you know, it's kind of, if you're keeping stuff that you really don't like, man, it goes back to the, you're cleaning its poop. That's on a day-to-day basis, that's what you're doing. And, you know, it might be cool to say, hey, I have rare snake X to your friends, but you know what? At the same time, if you just don't like it, if it's, you know, rare and that's why it's cool rather than being cool, you know, innately of itself, then just move on, man, honestly, and get it to someone who is passionate about it.
Yeah, because, you're absolutely right, because if you're not passionate about the species, then there might be somebody else that's super passionate. You know, I'm surrounded by guys like Zach, he's passionate about his blue tongue skinks, and, you know, Owen, he's super crazy about white lips. I mean, I think white lips are cool. I think blue tongue skinks are cool, but I probably will never own them, you know, and that's fine, you know, because I'm sure that I have stuff that those guys will never own and could probably care less about. You know what I mean? They'll probably say, wow, that's really cool, and look at it in the cage, and that's the end of it. And they'll appreciate, you know, what I've done or the fact that I'm keeping it alive, but, you know, it's not going to be their thing. Like, you know, Zach, you were talking earlier, like, you know, the size of a scrub getting bit in the face or what.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Me, man. I can't do it. No, I don't.
It's not your thing.
I can't do it. Nope.
It's not like you don't think that they're beautiful animals or anything like that, you know. Same thing with white lips. You know, when we went over and saw Owen's stuff, you know, I'm looking at them. They're beautiful animals, like really, really, really beautiful animals. You know, at this point, to me, if I got into that type of project, I just think that I would be doing the animal a disservice.
Because,
you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think more people have to think that way. And I think the reptile business or the hobby or whatever you want to call it would kind of work itself out, that people would be working with animals that they dig. And then other people that come along, because there's going to be another person that digs blue tongue skinks, and I'm going to send them to Zach. And there's going to be another guy that digs Halmaharas, and, you know, Zach's going to say, well, go see Eric and Rob. You know what I mean? Like, and that's kind of how I think the hobby or business or however you want to put it should be. I wish it was more like that, you know.
Oh, so. For sure. I mean, I think that's, I couldn't be more with you, you know.
It's, yeah.
Really, I mean, I think, you know, go ahead, Zach. Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to say, I also think it's important for people to experiment a little bit.
Yep.
You know, that's another thing. And you know, don't, you know, if you get a new animal, and don't go, see, here's the one thing. Get one. You don't have to get 12, you know, get one. You know, because that's all people are. They're like, well, I want to get a knobtail. 30 later, they're like, wait, I don't even like crickets. Why am I keeping knobtails, you know? Like, get one. See if you like it. You know, if you don't like it, you can move that one along and, you know, experiment that way. I mean, you know.
Or even to that same extent, the obsession. Man, the thing that kills me is the obsession with getting pairs, right? And I, you know, I get it. I hear you. But, I mean, at the same time, you know, so my undescribed monitors, whatever the heck these things are, I think they're both females, you know. But that doesn't mean I don't like them. It doesn't mean they're not cool. It doesn't mean I'm going to get rid of them. You know what I mean? That's not, I didn't buy them to breed them. You know what I mean? That wasn't my thought. And I think kind of, you know, Eric and I had been talking about this on Sunday. And, man, it bums me out that everything is about, well, you know, everything's a project. It's not just, man, they're just cool. You know what I mean? Can't we all just be like, yeah, they're just cool, dude. And you can figure out if they're cool with one. You know, if you, as you say, Zach, if you dig it, get another one. That's awesome. You know what I mean? But it doesn't have to be, man, you know, so I'm jumping in both feet, got six pairs, you know.
It's like, yeah.
When you don't like them, that's going to be, you know, you're going to feel that you don't like them a lot more strongly than if you only had one.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And viewed in the lens that, like, you know, was talked about earlier about how we're all kind of transitory, both in terms of projects and lifestyles and stuff, and it's like, man, everyone buys all these pairs. No, I only want females. I won't buy a male, you know, whatever, whatever, whatever. And it's like, man, if you even have that snake in 4 years, I'll give you your money back. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like, honestly, yeah. You know, it's one of those things. And that's not something that I'm, you know, I don't claim to be innocent on that either. I, you know, freely advertised that, you know, I have some of those rhinos that I have now, my adults, are ones that I got from Pro Exotics back in 2003 when they sold all their animals. I mean, my, you know, largest female is just this blue, cool-ass animal. You know, she's from 97 or 98, the first captive-bred babies imported to the United States of that species. You know, she's badass. Her brother just died this past year. You know, badass. But it's not... Those are the only snakes. Well, and then I have, you know, all those other wild ones from 2005, the remainder of those, that group. I don't think I've had anything else that I have I had that entire length of time. You know what I mean? And I'm someone who's obsessed with reptiles. You know, I've literally every day of my life, same as you two. You know, like, literally every day. I swear, dude, if I could capitalize it in some way, I'd be so crazy, wealthy, it's living funny, you know, but instead I'm just sitting there going, you know, I was talking to Eric about this, you know, his breeding books and stuff, and I'm right there with you, you know, at this point with my numbers and stuff, it's nowhere near as crazy, but I was sitting there at the bar exam preparation, you know, listening to the speaker, this is what you're going to need to remember for the test, and I'm sitting there planning out my, you know, Dione's pairings and stuff, you know, like, and, you know, that's who I am, that's who I've been the whole time, and you know, it's, you know, I said, damn, it's mental masturbation. You know, it's cool, though. There's, you know, that's fine. It's great. I'm on board with it. We're obsessed with snakes, and that's great. You know, but
right.
Even I have only, like, you know, 5% of my collection, probably even less than that in actuality, have I had for more than, you know, 6 or 7 years. And I think that's, you know, as I say, I think that's far more the norm than the exception. So I just get negative when people are like, you know, I won't buy a single animal, like you say, or whatever, because it leaves me saying, honestly, dude, if you have it in 4 years when they're, you know, old enough to breed and it hasn't changed hands 4 times, honestly, it's not even a question of, oh, I'll buy them back from you for the price that you paid me. I'll literally give it to you just as a congratulations, like, good job, dude. I'm proud of you.
Yeah. That's so funny.
So
yeah,
neither here nor there, I suppose. But and then you had mentioned the white lips. I like white lips a lot too, but I feel the same way, man. I've had, you know, blacks and gold. They're funny how they bite, you know, kind of that side swiping bite that they have.
Right.
And you know, so a couple points of interest, I suppose. So that T positive albino that's over in Denmark, right? Is that's right? Norway,
right.
Denmark, something like that.
Yep.
So I think, just as a clarification, so that's the same as the hypo, and I think, Chris, was it from Mystic, right? It came on and was talking about the green, that's what he was talking about too, so just as a clarification point, that's all that same snake, which actually is the same snake as what Protronics paid, you know, bought from Cameron back in the late 90s, 97, 98, something like that, that I think they had for a couple of years. I would assume that this guy more recently paid a lot less. Suffice it to say, they paid an awful lot of money for that scale nowhere. I know
really?
When Chris had been on, he had said, you know, he'd said, oh, I'd be willing to pay a few thousand dollars, you know, to get in that project just because it's cool. You know, I'm all for that. But I, certainly I can tell you that, you know, as far as I know, you know, the, again, opinion, not necessarily fact, but I think it's true. The, you know, initial offer price on that snake was, you know, at least 10 or 12 times that.
Wow.
So,
oh, man.
So, yeah. So presumably this one was cheaper and this guy's had better luck with it. And it's a cool critter. I don't know that there's really a ton of marketability to those, but, you know, it's neat. And it's neat that it's another chance to produce those animals that kind of went away when that earlier one passed away. So.
Sure. Right. That's cool. Yeah, like, you know, that's, I like the points you brought up as far as getting a single animal instead of, you know, always looking at a pair. And hell, I just made that same mistake with crested geckos, you know what I mean? And it's not to say that, you know, crested geckos are cool or whatever, but, you know, I had six of them and it was like, this just isn't me, man. I don't,
yeah.
You know, the reason that I kind of got them was because I kind of looked, you know, was thinking like if I'm at a show, I want somebody else to come up and kind of, you know, mistake. I shouldn't have been thinking it like that. You know what I mean? Because I wasn't thinking about what's driving me. And meanwhile, I'm focusing on, you know, taking care of these crested geckos and I'm not focusing on what I should be focusing on. And it's just not my thing, you know. They're cool. I dig them, you know. But not my
process.
I know. Zach's watching. He's like, he's like, this isn't going to work.
No, I was like, Eric, there's no way, dude. You're like, the first week, you're super psyched. The second week, you're like, dude, they won't eat. The third week, you're like, I can't stand this shit. And the fourth week, gone. Like, gone.
Yep. Yep. Oh, my gosh.
Yep. But I moved on, you know. I moved on quick. And the cool thing about that is that it kind of made me think and get back to, you know, and you know, everybody busts my balls because of the copybook and all that kind of stuff. But when I first got back into this, you know, like I said, I was keeping a whole mix of different pythons and all this kind of stuff. And I had Chinese water dragons and Savannah monitors and all these different type of reptiles. And, you know, Zach, you were here last night, the snake that's in my room, he's old as dirt. He's been in my collection.
Mm-hmm.
Since that time, you know, and he's still there, and he's a carpet python. So, I mean, to me, I've been through berms, I've been through African rocks, I've had retics, I've had blood pythons and all these different types, and it always stays back with the carpet pythons. And, you know, that's just what I need to focus on, you know. And if I would have just stayed the path and stayed on my focus with Morelia, and it's not to say that other stuff isn't cool, it's just for me, that's what works inside my reptile room, you know, and that's what I don't care about cleaning up its shit, you know. I'm fine with keeping up with cleaning up Morelia shit because I think it makes really good coffee too, by the way. That Papua New Guinea stuff is shit.
Yeah, Papua New Guinea coffee, bro. That stuff is awesome.
So, you know, I hope, you know, this just, I know I'm kind of going on a tangent with my soapbox, but this whole show, this whole idea kind of started from when listening to shows like Reptile Radio and listening to those guys talk. And, you know, I constantly would ask them questions. Can you get somebody that's going to talk about carpet pythons? Can you talk about somebody, you know, get this guy on, you know, every time they would talk about a carpet python guy or anything with Morelia, I'd send them in a question, you know, just to know that, you know, hey, I, this is cool. You know, I really dig this and I hope you do more of it. And, you know, finally I just said, you know, the main thing that I took from those guys is that do what you love to do. And that's how this kind of came about. You know, everybody was saying that, you know, who's going to listen to a show about carpet pythons or Morelia, or, you know, that's that own little niche of the world of reptiles that nobody kind of pays attention to. But, you know, I don't know. That's what I dig. I don't care if nobody listens. You know what I mean? I don't care if it's just me and Owen talking to ourselves. It doesn't matter to me because I'm going to keep doing it because it's what I love to do, you know, and hopefully other people get, you know, get can, that can get is contagious to other people. And I think that's what people need to learn to do is get behind their project. And I said that word. It's kind of like Sid. You shouldn't say that word. When you say project, you get zapped. you know, but you know what I'm saying. So
yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, and I think that kind of fits into, you know, one thing that I've seen that I think, you know, has been kind of an ongoing debate with you guys is kind of this question of if you were to do it, you know, full time, if you'd need to have ball python. And I think kind of there's been some vacillation on that issue. But, man, I feel like it's the crested gecko thing all over again. Like, okay, maybe I would see it at the most. Maybe there's some truth to that. If you got all your animals that were top-notch that compete, you know, with the, you know, all the Joneses for free. But if you're going to have to spend all this money to catch up, then, you know, you what you make up won't nearly, you know, satisfy that amount that you're paying out because it's not your passion. And B, because it's not, you're not going to be, you know, obsessed with it in that same way. You're not going to pursue it in the same way. And it's like, that'd just be spinning your wheels. So don't do that.
Right.
That's my opinion, you know, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of why I kind of look at it this way, though. It's like, you know, a lot of people say that could you do this full time? Could you not do this full time? I kind of think that if you can produce enough clutches of eggs and you promote what you're doing and people kind of take to it, I think that you could be successful at it. But I think there's a lot of factors in that, you know, you can't be worrying about what other people think and you know what I mean? Because I just think that if you're going to get into ball pythons, who are you going to go to? You're going to go to somebody who's popular in the ball python world. People wouldn't know who the hell I am. You know what I mean? So like they're going to, if you had your choice to get, you know, if you're going to go and invest $5,000 into a ball python, are you going to go to Brian Barczyk or are you going to go to Eric Burke?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
The same thing was true with the chondros, right? It was Dan Sutherland, right? Produced those blue chondros, and all the chondro folks said, who the hell are you? You know, I'm not trusting you. Yep. Those animals are what you say they are, you know? Like, and
right.
Here's a guy who's, you know, owns ballpython.com. He must have got in pretty early to have that, you know, as his name.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he's a well-known breeder. You know what I mean? He's not like
some
new guy to the block, you know, and people won't pay attention to him. So, you know, I just think that, if you go and you spend the time pimping out, I say pimping out the species you work with and going on a forum or on Facebook or whatever your thing is and just showing people what you're doing. I think over time, it's not going to happen overnight. Over time, people are going to start to pay attention to what you're doing, you know. That's my secret with IJs. You know?
Yes.
Hey, man, IJs are badass. I don't know.
Thank you.
I don't know where
the
batteries come from.
Yeah, you know, nobody cares, and I get it because, you know, when you're at a show or something like that, you're looking across and you see that black and yellow snake and you're like, holy shit, you know. But when you get IJs to that level, people will start to pay attention.
Yeah, that Hannibal animal that Caponetto had, I mean, the, you know.
Oh, Hannibal.
Animals, all that stuff. Oh, man, even, what's that black one you had, that poison ivy one? That thing is badass, dude.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know I mean, it's not a taste for anybody, or for everybody, right? But, I mean, in the same way, when you're saying, you know, pimp out your projects and stuff, okay, well, so you'll move some of those animals, and some of those, you know, will be the people who end up, You're convincing them. You're selling them on that project. Some of those people will like it and some won't. And that's fine. But really then, the folks who are into it, that you hook into, man, that's going to be your base. Those 10, 15, 20 people, if you are doing it, you know, professionally, those are going to be those people will be your breadwinners for sure. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So,
so.
And really, that's all that matters. I mean, you don't need, you know, honestly, and I think that's the way most, that's certainly the way I prefer to deal with stuff. I'd rather sell stuff to the same 30, 40, 50 people, not because of anything other than, well, I know them, they know me, it's kind of, you know, it's casual and stuff. There is some aspect of saying I should try and reach out to new people, bring them into the community. But frankly, man, the stuff I'm working with, you know, I think rhinos are a good fit for that, but they're expensive, you know, or at least relatively speaking. You know, they're more than a corn snake. So,
right.
You know, I think corn snakes make good pets. Cow kings make good pets. I do have 30 variable king snakes, all of which I purchased, which are probably 50 to 250 pets. So maybe that's the option that I have, you know, once those are feeding, that I can push to just generally. But, you know, I mean, really, I think that's, it's a mistake to think I need to reach, man, nothing bums me out more than people trying to, you know, push their Facebook likes or something, saying, oh, I want to get 1,000 likes or whatever. When I get 1,000 likes, I'll give away a snake to some random person. It's like, dude, I'd much rather, it's no surprise that when that happens, the animal that's given away, you see it sold like 3 or 4 times immediately, because it's like, dude, you've been better served keeping the 250, in my case, 125 people that like my page. And, you know, all those people, presumably, to the extent they're not just, you know, non-snake friends of mine or whatever, like, you know, all those people are really into the stuff I have. And so if I
right.
were ever to do that, I'd want one of those people to get it, not just some random person who signed up to get a free snake.
Yeah.
So that's just me.
Right.
Yeah, I hear you on that. We're just so everybody knows, I'll say this now, we're going to go into OT, and if it's okay with you guys, we'll hit the rhino rat stuff in the OT section, so people have to come
sure.
back and listen once, once
dude,
the show, you know, all the
people.
It's going to be like the secret extended version of NPR right there. But now I lost the thought of what I was going to say, what you were just saying. Damn. Shit, there was something you wanted me to make sure that we got out. And I think,
so yeah, we talked about the cross-contamination stuff. See, I haven't even looked at my list yet. Oh, here is one thing that I just want to run through with you because it's interesting to me, although, frankly, I was re-listening today and I think you mentioned that Maynard had actually done this, but I've been curious why it hadn't, and I kind of thought maybe there was some politics behind it or people were being quiet. And I'm not a hybrid guy at all. You know, personally, that's the thing with all my, you know, variable kings and stuff. They were hybridized really early, which makes it even tougher to track than some of this, you know. I guess it's super similar to the carpet stuff, to be honest. You know, in terms of,
right.
like, the hybridization on this stuff isn't going to be the guy I got it from or even the guy he got it from. It's going to be, you know, Mexico's been realistically closed for about, you know, 25 years. So it's going to, the stuff I'm concerned about is what happened, you know, 15 to 20 years ago. And kind of in that same frame, so that's just kind of the caveat, tossing it out there. But at the same time, if you're cool with hybridizing, I'm very curious why no one's pursuing albino inlands. Because, man, if you mix that orange in with those blues and turn that thing into an albino, it's going to be like a flaming blueberry, dude.
You know, I think Maynard did do that. I'm pretty sure he did. You know,
do you think other people have pursued it too and just kind of no one's talking about it? Or what do you think?
You know, when it comes to that thing, I think that because inlands are so new to the carpet python world, I think that at least I'll give you my thought on my thought process on it. When I got into it, diamonds and jungles and coastals, they were all screwed up. So
right.
I kind of felt that, well, the damage is done. So I might as well enjoy the party,
oh,
you
man.
Know what I mean?
Yeah.
I know. Zach's over there.
Oh,
you're
killing Zach over here.
But, I mean, I guess I think that with an inland, I don't know, I just have a different thought process in my head when it comes to that. I hear what you're saying, and I don't understand why my brain won't go to that level. You know,
It's that line all the hybridizers have. It's a line, and they can't go over that line, but they go right up to the line, and for some
and
reason,
it's
yeah, a diamond
bullshit,
coastal
because
you'll own. Yeah, but you won't own a coastal inland cross. It's like, what?
Yeah.
Like, it's just, yeah, it's silly. I think it's silly.
We lost you. Did he fall into the background, Zach? Do you hear him still?
Yeah, he's like really, really faint, I think.
Yeah. We kind of lost you.
I'll try back in.
We can hear him, but it's just really, really faint.
Yeah, really low. I mean, that's a good point. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense why you would not cross that and you would cross other things. You know, it's just kind of silly. I don't know. I don't know.
It may be because we don't have as many. I know the reason why we do it. Because we don't have as many in the States as terms of inland. So people don't have inland yet to even cross them. So, but that will come.
I know.
We all know it's going to come.
I know that people will do it. And there will be certain people that won't care. And they'll go to it. And, you know, it'll be what it is, you know. And I don't know. I just think that. I guess my thought with that is that you can't even see what the potential of an inland is yet. So why would you go and just kind of mix
true.
It?
Even more than like the inland, I'm surprised more people haven't done like albino brettles or something. You know what I mean? Like that would be the first thing in my mind. If I was going to hybridize something, it'd be like, albino brettles? What? That would be ridiculous.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah.
So.
An albino.
I don't know. It's funny.
Yeah, I hope that he can call back in because I'm thinking that he might not be able to because the show. Hold on one sec. Yeah, it might not let him because now we're recording, so I don't know if it's going to let him call in or not. Can you hear me? Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, that sucks, man. I should have told him not to, what do you call it? Damn it. Let me try to hold on one sec. While we wait, unless you want it, Zach, why don't you talk about what you have available, and I'm going to go try to message him on Facebook. You cool with that?
What I have available. Okay, sure. A free advertisement. I'm down with that. All good. What do I have available? All righty.
Yeah, what do you have available? Go for it.
Okay. Well, I guess I could talk about this. I had my female coastal. She is 50% M-Pen, 50% Sylvester line. She was produced by Nick. She produced Clutch this year, and those are currently what I have for sale. Three animals from that clutch. One's the Jag. And two are Tiger Jag. The father is a Tiger Jag from Mr. Jason Balin himself. And yeah, they're really cool. They just all had their second shed, eating real well and everything. So if you're interested in any of those, I have the pictures up on Facebook. You can go check them out. Dark Side Exotics, that's two words, Dark Side and Northern Exotics. So yeah, they're really cool. I also have some jungles coming up for sale soon, I know. Dark Side Jungle. There are also the two, the Dam and the Shire, were both produced by Nick, and they had very faint striping. Their parents don't have a lot of striping, but I figured if they were bred together, more striping would pop out, and it did. So I got a few of them that have really nice stripes, and they would be really good for any kind of outcalls project, any skunk line or any finding my animals, so that's really why I created that clutch. And they're going to go up sale maybe in a month or so. They're actually having their first feeding trials tonight, so we'll see how that goes. Wish me luck on that. And other than that, a couple of males are going up. The tiger jack from that pairing is going up to fail the male. He's ready to go. He's gonna rock whatever female he's gonna win this year. And that's about it. About all I have to tell right now. Yeah. I think Eric bailed on me. The pressure is mounting.
Okay, so here's where we're at. He couldn't call back in because the show was in to record.
Uh-huh.
Okay. But what's going to happen is he'll come on next week because I don't have a guest book for next week. So we'll just continue the combo next week. And,
could you go and erase the last 3 minutes?
No, I can't. Why? Well, you're talking about your snakes? Come on, man. You got some cool shit. I saw it.
Yeah, but you kind of, you know, you kind of put me on the spot there, Eric. You know what I mean?
Oh.
Kind of like, you know.
Well, we didn't want dead air, man. So, you know, you go for it. That's it. You're all right. You rocked it out. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So did you throw out, like, your Facebook page and all that kind of stuff?
Yes, sir.
Have some morning coffee with Zach? Yeah.
Oh, I didn't explain that. Morning coffee's good, man. Except Owen kind of was, he gave us a backlash. I posted up a morning coffee at like 6 p.m. because I forgot to in the morning. And then Owen was like, wow, it's kind of late for morning coffee. Wow, Owen, thanks.
You got to leave it up to Owen, the bus balls, you know what I mean? That's just how he goes.
Crazy.
Maybe it's
crazy.
Tell him it's morning in Australia at 6 o'clock. So there you go.
Yeah,
what the
hell?
You're,
exactly.
Keeping your Australian fans happy. Go ahead.
Exactly. The concept of a morning coffee is, you know, every morning I make my coffee, I go down to my reptile room, have coffee with the animal, you know, make sure, you know, because usually, as you know, they're up all night. So when you come in the morning into the room, you always find some kind of surprise, right? You know, either one has shed, one has pooped. One has escaped. No, I'm kidding. But, you know, like, something has happened. One has ripped down the heat panel from its cage. Something has happened. So, usually. So, you know, morning coffee, the concept is take a little photo, something I find interesting throughout the morning, post it up, you know, just for everybody to see what's going on over here and keep everybody up to date. So, yeah, I'm actually surprised of kept up with it as long as I have, you know, 3 weeks so far, so I'm going to keep it going.
Yeah, I like it. I think it was a good idea. You know, it's kind of like it's a way to keep you focused on taking pictures or updating things every day, you know what I mean? So
yep.
It's a cool thing.
Yeah,
cool idea.
I found myself like, you know, weeks without posting anything. I'm like, wait a minute, like, what's your problem?
Right. Well, that's cool. Yeah, so, yeah, go over and I'm going to throw your Facebook page up over on the Morelia Python Radio Facebook page so that people can go and check it out.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to do this as I talk to you, which I'm not very good at. Typing and
multitasking.
Yeah, I can multitask. I just can't type and talk, man. Which is crazy because I can play drums and do guitar. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't get it. So, anyway,
play drums, the guitar, and sing all at once.
Yeah, singing and playing guitar.
Singing
and playing guitar was something that was not easy to learn how to do. But once you get it down, it's kind of like. So I guess I'm going to have to sit at my computer and practice typing as I talk and try to make sure that my conversation is fluid as I type in dark outside exotics. There we go. Let's see what comes up. It won't let me leave the page. Anyway, I'll get that going. So what did you think of Rob, man?
Dude, he's like my kind of nerd.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, totally, dare I say, passionate about, like, everything he's doing, you know, really into it. He's a wealth of knowledge. Yeah, really, really cool. Easy to talk to. Definitely good, you know.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Honestly, some guys are a little intimidated to talk to him, you know what I mean, on the phone. They're like, I don't know, like, it's true. Like, I don't remember who, but there's a couple guys who are like, you kind of stay talking to them because, you know, I don't know. Rob seemed like a really easygoing cat. And frankly, the fact that he started talking blue tongues off the bat, man, me and him can hang, you know, we can have a beer, you know what I mean? We can totally chill out. And I could just be like, blue tongue, blue tongue, blue tongue, and he could be just nodding his head, and it'd be good.
Yeah. Yeah, I told you, it's like we were talking, I was telling you that usually I don't like to talk to people before the show because I find that I kind of like that surprise or that excitement.
Spontaneous.
That I get myself when I talk to the guest, and I find that it makes for a better show. But Rob had called and talked to me the other day, and you know, we were talking, and before we knew it, it's three, four hours later, and you know, I was like, damn, we should have made that a show, you know. So
yeah, we should have recorded it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a cool guy. So I guess I'll just let everybody know, in case you didn't hear. We had some technical difficulties. He couldn't call back in. But Rob will be on next week for round two to talk about the rhino rat snakes, which I know really nothing about. But what a cool species. I mean, look-wise, I can't think of anything that kind of looks like that. And, you know, that's one of those things. He was on Reptile Radio a little while back. And he was talking about the rhino rat snakes. And even though that's a perfect example of what I was talking about earlier, I don't know if I would ever own a rhino rat snake, but I sure do dig them talking about them. You know what I mean? Like, I
hell
can
yeah.
listen to him
yeah.
and I can get into what he's saying, and it's fascinating and it's cool, and I dig what he's doing, and you know, it's cool stuff. So if that's the kind of species that you know, you were thinking about or you're on the fence about, you know, Rob's your guy. So he'll be on next week, and he's going to break it down for us like we don't know nothing about rhino rat snakes. And
yeah, and even if you're not even interested in a rhino rat, dude, all reptile knowledge is good knowledge, man. You can apply any hugging tree tactics to any reptile. And it all connects, man. It's all the same. So, you know, I was explaining that to somebody else a couple of days ago that, you know, no matter what kind of book you're – hell, even on ball pythons, you don't read up on them. You know, it may surprise you. You may learn something about your chondra that you never would have thought. Or, you know, it just opens your mind to more ideas and more possibilities. And that's always a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, it was like I was saying earlier, like Reptile Radio. Those guys really focused on ball pythons, and that was their thing. But, you know, it's still a python, and you can take that knowledge and you can apply it to what you're doing. Rob's a good guy to listen to on some of his thoughts on acclimating wild-caught species. So for your chondro people, for the scrub people, you know, it's good to hear his thoughts and what he's doing to have success with these rhino rat snakes, because from what I understand, they're all imported, right? I mean, he's breeding them in captivity, but the group that he's working with, I think, were all pretty much wild caught. So yeah, it's cool stuff. One of the things that he wanted me to make sure that he hit on is that when we were talking in our conversation about wild caught animals and acclimation and all that kind of stuff. He made a statement, and he said he wanted to try to make sure that he hit on this, was the fact that he would take wild-caught animals rather than taking captive born and bred animals from certain people's collections. You know, there's certain breeders out there that he would much rather work with the wild caught animal than so don't always be afraid. You know, again, I think it comes to that idea that because, you know, I keep my snake outside of my reptile room and this is the quarantine spot, that somehow there's no way that, you know, I can infect my collection with whatever it is that you think you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. like, the idea mm-hmm. is just because it's captive born and bred that somehow this thing is bulletproof, and, you know, it's not always the case, but, so. Mm-mm. So, yeah, good stuff. So, yeah, I don't really have anything else to hit on, but Rob will be back again next week, so good times. I want to thank you, Zach, for coming on and hosting the show with me, not leaving me out there all by myself.
No problem.
Because that's never fun.
Not a problem, man.
So you start with you. Give your info again, and then I'll run down the list, and we'll call it a show.
All right, so I'm pretty much a Facebook junkie. So that's pretty much where you're going to find me. So if you need to contact me, just hit me up at Dark Side Exotics. Two words, Dark Side. And or you could contact me at Zach Baez on Facebook as well. Baez is B-A-E-Z. You can message me. You can talk to me about Blue Tongue. You know, whatever you want to do, I'm willing to talk. I always talk reptiles, so, you know, I don't mind talking about anything. And that's it.
There you go. Good stuff.
Oh, wait, one more thing.
Oh, wait. Yeah, go ahead.
I started a page a couple weeks ago called Taliqua Stick of the Week. And if anybody doesn't know what Taliqua is, it's the genus that all blue tongues fall under. So, yes, it is a play on words on the Morelia Pick of the Week. Thank you, Eric, for letting me use that. And so if you're interested in blue tongues, you want, you know, or maybe you're kind of curious about them or whatever, or maybe you just want to see cool pictures of funky-looking animals, just, you know, hop on there and join up. And it seems to be gaining a little bit of ground, you know, a lot of really cool people and people I really admire are actually on there and posting, so that's, like, really, really neat to me. So I just wanted to plug that in, so if anybody's interested in just having a discussion about them, that's a great place to do it. So that's it.
Cool. Yeah, cool stuff. There's some really, really really cool blue tongues over there on that page. And, you know, you guys have mentioned before,